Welcome, everyone. I'm Patricia Rossi, the VP of Engagement for the Academy of Marketing Science. Thank you for joining us for the first episode of AMS Illuminations, a podcast series by the Academy of Marketing Science that brings together AMS fellows for deep dives into the ever-changing world of marketing. In AMS Illuminations, we will explore career tips, strategies for forging successful research partnerships, groundbreaking marketing studies, and the game-changing impact of new technologies. For our first episode, we are joined by Obina Obilu and Brad Carlson to discuss how to bridge the gap between the academic and practitioner worlds. Obi is an innovation and strategy specialist at Nestlé, focused on keeping the consumer at the core of the innovation process for the global coffee category. Formerly, Obi was an associate professor of marketing at Central Michigan University. His research has been published in many top journals, including Journal of Business Research, Marketing Letters, and Journal of Strategic Marketing. Brad is professor of marketing at St. Louis University and the current president of AMS. He has received several awards for teaching, service, and research. His research has appeared in many top journals, including the Journal of the Academy of Marketing Science, Journal of Market Research, and the Journal of Business Research. Thank you both for joining us today. The floor is yours.
Thank you so much for putting all of this together. Obi, it's great to see you. It's been too long, my friend.
I know. It's excellent. I miss all my AMS friends and just collaborating, hanging out, being social, being professional, all of that together. I really miss that. Even as I've started my new journey, I really miss that camaraderie I have with all my colleagues over the last 14, 15 years or so, you know, like being at AMS and in academia as a whole. So glad to be back and glad to see everyone here.
One of our initiatives at AMS, as you know, trying to bridge the gap between academics and practice. And I can't think of a better person to discuss that with than someone who's literally bridged the gap, moving from academics to practice. So I'm definitely looking forward to this conversation and hearing some of your insights. I'm curious for you, what initially motivated you to be interested in academic life?
My background is a little different from perhaps some of our colleagues. I started in engineering, so I was an electrical engineer, and my first career was in working in consulting for oil and gas companies. So doing a lot of their electrical substation work or refineries in the oil and gas space. I know it sounds like some other crazy world here, but that's really what my initial interest was, and I love that world. And as I went back to get my master's in engineering, they just started this hybrid program where if you're not engaging in a full MBA or enrolling in a full MBA program, you can take a few MBA classes while you're getting your engineering master's degree. So I'm working on my engineering degree and just dabbling in some MBA classes. And one of the first classes I had in that MBA light program was a marketing management class, marketing 530 or so, I believe, and the professor was Barry Davitt. So this is way back in 2008, 2009, sometime in that space. And I just loved the material from my first day in class. I just thought it was the coolest thing ever. We were working on a few interesting case studies. It's just, you know, me and my group trying to solve these problems, thinking like a consultant, but in, you know, a completely different space that I was used to in engineering. I fell in love with the subject matter. And Barry will confirm this, but I think I was one of only a couple of people that got an A in this class because I just loved it so much. I had a conversation with him after that, just asking how I could kind of further my experience in that space. And he told me, and I remember this vividly, he's like, you know, you might be interested in getting into our doctoral program. And I'm thinking, you know, what is this? How much longer do I have to be in school? And so on and so forth. Because, you know, coming back to grad school, I was like, I'm not making any money. I've been making money the past few years. And, you know, and I was listening to Barry and hearing you say, and we're like, yeah, perhaps, you know, you're going to be in school for four more years. I'm like, there's no way I'm going to do that. I'm not coming back for a doctoral program for four more years. I want to go back and make, you know, money in the real world again. But, you know, the more I thought about it, the more I worked on some of that material. It was just an opportunity I wasn't going to pass up. Just wanting to learn more, particularly what I focused on was consumers in this marketing space and how we can get to the heart of consumers, how we can understand the psychology of consumer behavior, and how we can actually overlay that with the economic side of things, that was really what was interesting to me and why I decided to go into academia, you know, 4 more years in school. It's an experience I would never get back. I would do it again and again if I had a time machine to go back.
You mentioned those doctoral sessions at your first AMS conference. Can you talk a little about that experience? What was it like experiencing that, preparation for that? Obviously, you talked about the MBA experience. Now you're in the middle of the PhD program. You're attending a conference. You're interacting with all these academics doing this research. What was that experience like for you?
It was an interesting first dive into the space. I remember at my first AMS conference, I had to present. And I'd given many presentations, you know, in different fields where I had different strengths. And public speaking is something I've always enjoyed. I felt like that I've always been, I'd say decent, not being braggadocious, decent at public speaking. But coming here and having to speak, you know, as a doctoral student with other faculty members there, it was one of the most nerve-wracking things that I've ever experienced. My very first presentation at AMS. And, you know, going back to not harping on my lover family, Academy of Marketing Science. And I remember, I believe John Ford was one of those professors at the time in that session. You know, over time, we've become more of colleagues now. But just seeing John and Barry and some of the people in that session, I was so nervous. But the way they approached giving critical feedback really is what, going back to the harping on this military, really is what made me love this conference. It wasn't about criticizing or telling me, well, this is not the best approach or that's dumb or anything like that. It was more about this collaboration to co-create better research. And that's essentially how I saw AMS. And so I went from nervous in my very first presentation to, you know, as I went in future years, it was more about, okay, I have this neat idea. It's not fully fleshed out. I'm not nervous to bring it out here because I know that the spirit of camaraderie is here. How can we build and co-create this idea together? Perhaps there are experiences that person X might have that I've never seen. It doesn't matter how much further they are than I am in the discipline. They have valuable input that can help me shape this idea to something better. And that's something that I really appreciated. It was more about building together and not just tearing people down.
Do you see any similarities in your experience now in practice in terms of openness, the receptiveness of the people that you're speaking to for ideas that are not fully fleshed out? Because that's a lot of what we do in academics is we come up with questions. You know, I talk to PhD students all the time. I say, by the time you get out of here, you shouldn't have all the answers, but you should be more prepared to ask the right questions. That's a little different from sitting around the boardroom table and making a pitch. So what do you see in terms of similarities, differences between how we approach new ideas in academics versus in practice?
I can only explain this from my use case. And Brad, I've joked with you about speed being the critical differentiator between academia and practice, right? Our metrics are different. Our success factors are different. Our KPIs are different. Speed is critical where you have several competitors. So I can speak in a particular space. I work in CPG. We're making consumer packaged goods, fast moving consumer goods, and fast is embedded in the main. You have to be one of the first people to market with your ideas. So you don't just become what we call a B2 product. So after two or three other firms have actually launched this product, you don't want to be the brand that comes in and say, me too, I have a product in the space. So speed is critical as part of our success factors because profit is obviously a metric that we're judged on as well. But the interesting thing about it is in the particular space where I sit is something called front-end innovation. Meaning, I sit in the R&D space, which is exciting because a lot of people I get to work with, besides being business and consumer people, or scientists, or chemical engineers, or people working on creating these new recipes, these new ideas. Well, my particular focus is just making sure that as we're innovating all these new ideas, think about it as new product development. As we're creating new products, right, we want to make sure the consumer is at the forefront. So within the space where I sit in R&D, while all those metrics, you know, the profitability, all those KPIs we measure are still extremely important, there's a lot more tolerance for ambiguity. There's a lot more tolerance for go out there and really talk to this ever-evolving consumer, this ever-changing consumer. What's happening in their world and how do we bring their voice to guide our science and technology in the development of food and beverages for consumers all around the world? So yes, as a whole, there's a lot more things need to happen very quickly. But where I sit specifically within research and development, there's a little bit more tolerance, still faster. You know, our research still has to happen faster. So we don't have the time to say, well, we're going to go through this review process over the next 6 months. That's absolutely mental in this world, right? We're talking in weeks instead of months and things. We're having multiple research and research loops happening within the span of a month versus having all the time to go back, really think about this ambiguous concept that we truly want to understand, fleshing it out and getting into this extremely rigorous process of peer review and peer feedback. Our focus more is on how can we get great information in the fastest way possible? And we get to work with a lot of research partners around the world on this. So there's still some room. Some tolerance for ambiguity, but speed has to be a critical factor that's incorporated into that overall learning and tolerance for ambiguity. So differences, but we're seeing some of that openness to learning from how academia approaches problems as well.
The feedback process. So you mentioned the journal process. Obviously, it's a lengthy process, somewhat slow, but it's also, it's a blind process, which I'm curious, what is the feedback process from your perspective? Between practice and academics, where in academics, we have people who they don't know where the idea is coming from necessarily, who's proposing this idea. You're not dealing with that same type of situation in the boardroom. They're looking at you as you deliver this information. Do you notice any type of difference in the quantity of feedback, the quality of feedback? Is there a perceivable difference in getting blind feedback versus someone looking you in the face and saying, that idea is not solid?
It's a distinct process. And this is where I would say the first divergence really happens between academia and practice. The blind process is absolutely necessary as we continue to build the body of knowledge of academia. We want to make sure that we are truly pushing the boundaries and learning. But as we continue to incorporate the scientific process, we want to make sure there are no biases. As you and I might be writing this paper, and we want to make sure that our peers, people at the same level as us, have the ability to critically question, you know, the things, the thought that we're putting forth to make sure that this actually contributes to growing the body of knowledge. It's different in practice because we don't have this peer grouping. The boardroom might be, you know, and this is where we see more of a hierarchy, right? The people that are sitting in that boardroom and you're making these presentations to are definitely above you in that hierarchy because you're giving them the input to enable their decisions that eventually brings those profits in the future. But the boardroom puts that absolute trust in you by appointing you to this specific position as the gatekeeper of the research, as the presenter of the ideas. They have the utmost trust in you. It's not a contingent or a series of peers critically assessing an idea to make sure it meets the standard of contribution to our overall body of knowledge. It's more, you are the bastion. You are the gatekeeper of this knowledge, and we trust that this research you're bringing in because of this faith we have in you, this research you're bringing us, guides us to make the right decisions on where we invest our resources to bring products to market. So that's where that main divergence exists between practice and academia.
And as you talk about those types of situations and your academic training that's being utilized in the world of practice, how much do you look back or pull from academic research now that you're making decisions for real brands, real companies in the marketplace?
I will say it's twofold here. The first fold is the process in and of itself. Because we have they're not diametrically opposed, but two different approaches to research in academia and practice. One that emphasizes rigor and making sure that there is enough of a contribution, and another that still wants that rigor, but emphasizes speed. You know, what my academic training brings is the process. It's how can I, within this framework of moving a lot faster, still bring that rigorous process into this overall approach to research and practice? That's something my academic training brings. How can I engage with some of the research partners you work in with to make sure that that rigorous analysis, that rigorous approach to answering questions is still incorporated into this research process. So yeah, and that's where my academic research I've seen, or my academic training has brought the most value, is thinking properly, thinking through critically addressing consumer questions, not just asking general, very broad-based questions, but really bringing that in-depth assessment of the consumer into the questioning that we do with our practice research. That's where my academic training has really helped me. And the second fold is my academic training within the context where AI works, if I look at consumer behavior, is there enough work coming out of there that is being utilized in practice? And I think that's where we can get better in academia. In the first phase, absolutely. The process, the training, the rigor, but rigor and speed, there's a lot of training that is automatically just being able to be applied in that space. But in the actual work coming out from academia and its relevance to practice, and I can speak in the consumer space specifically, are there tons of research that we're seeing being applied on a day-to-day basis or having value for practitioners on a day-to-day basis? And I feel like that's where we really need to incorporate, we need to bring our efforts into bridging that gap. Process, great, but how do we bring content greater and lifting that bridge? Is it perhaps developing a subfield that really focuses on more practice versus building theory overall? Or is there some kind of evolution or some kind of interaction that happens there? I can't really fully map what that should look like, but I know for a fact that there should be more efforts, at least from the academic side, towards really bringing out content that bridges that gap, being more relevant to practice so we can see more of that being used on a day-to-day basis.
So clearly you have firsthand experience of sitting around and having a conversation about academic research with practitioners. If you could share with everyone who's listening to this, because most of us are going to be working on academic research, what did the conversation consist of? What were the things that sitting around the table, those who did look at this article and this research, what are the things that they were paying attention to? What are the things that maybe were not being discussed or, you know, were not as relevant for the conversation? Because I think that's a really good way for us as academics to bridge that gap is to speak the language and address issues that are relevant.
That is an easy question. Managerial implications. That was it. Just a clearly defined section on managerial implications that was in layman speak that could easily be translated into action. If we have a 15, 25 page journal article that has, you know, a lit review section, right? Connection to theory section, methodological section, results section. Folks sitting around in practice really are not paying attention to those first 20 or 25 pages. It's almost like we get down right to the managerial implications section. What is the story that the results of this research telling that is relevant to me in practice? That is all that was discussed. Nobody paid us, you know, a second of attention to methods. And it's interesting because these folks I'm talking to are all people that have varying levels of expertise in methodology. They've worked for all the big research agencies around the world. So it's not like they are folks that have more methodological experience. These are really highly trained researchers. Yet, that was not their focus because speed is important. How can we find a story here? And the thing is, there's a lot of respect from practice towards academia, a lot of respect. So essentially, the whole point is we trust all the research you've done. We trust your theory building. We trust the methods you're using. We're not questioning any of that. We believe that because of the rigor that is implied within academia, that you've done your due diligence and it's gone through the peer review process. So we trust that all of that is great and awesome. Now, because we trust all of that, we don't have the time to review that. What is the actual story here that has relevance to me? So my contention would be that's just a very simple way to really start to make these things relevant to practice is tell a managerial story. Don't just summarize the results and say X, Y, and Z. Tell some story as to how, you know, my findings in this space from experiments 1, 2, 3, and 4 actually have relevance to what practitioners are doing in the real world. You know, even if it's tangential link, start to make those links and tell a story. Practitioners love a story that is clear and is connected to what they're doing.
All right, so I'm going to put you on the spot and I'm going to challenge you to put back on your academic hat. You've been on the side where you're writing these articles and you've spent 2 years doing this research. And now you're trying to put in clear, articulated words. Here's what my implications are for managers. I have a couple components to this question. First of all, when you were in academics writing these articles, did you feel like you were good, that you were effective at communicating the managerial implications of your research?
If that's the first question, I would say across the works that I worked on, No, I wasn't. I wasn't perfect. And I think a lot of us would share that same sentiment that we may not necessarily have been perfect. And, you know, the issue at hand here is much larger than just what me or you or I know the research is working on. Is the way we approach the academy as a whole and the academy and the academia as a whole. And that discussion is much larger than just this conversation. It's what is that research process? What does that look like? Is it just this rat race to get as many publications as possible? And there are defined ways and approaches to the way you're supposed to craft this research so it fits within those channels, those pipelines, those ways of working for research. And when that becomes inculcated into academics, you know, straight from our PhD program to being professors out there in the world, we learn if you need to publish Journal A, these are the steps you have to follow. So you start writing in that particular way without necessarily thinking about managerial implications. So I think a lot of us get guilty of that in thinking about how do we get this. You know, yes, the idea is great, the rigor is great, but how do we get this shaped properly to fit within X journal or Y journal? And that really removes some of that necessity to think about how this would be practical for managers. But to add to that, I did say the last topic we were discussing here that we could certainly have various pillars of research, if you will, where we could have research that's purely conceptual that really may not have any implications for managers, and there's room for that. And then journals could also have research that builds on theory by using some of the methods, all the different methods, qualitative, that we've learned and continue to work with to build on theory. But I believe that we can also have a clearly defined pillar that has implications for practice. And again, let it not just be a natural fallout from the research we do, but actually, a clearly defined pathway for certain researchers that want to work in that space, the resources dedicated to helping and getting those researchers to want to publish in those spaces. So I think if we can clearly define research relevance for practice as a sub-pillar of all of our research, I think we can begin to bridge that gap and make some of us, or a lot of us, more effective in telling that story to managers. So to answer your first question, I don't think I was as effective in my time, but I think steps like I just outlined might be one way to address that for researchers that want to work in that space.
Obi, thanks for your response to that question and all of the insights that you've shared up to this point. We still have a lot of topics to discuss, but we'll do that when we continue this conversation in episode 2 of AMS Illuminations.
Thank you for joining us for part 1 of Obi and Brad discussion. Please join us next week for the next part of the conversation. And be sure to subscribe to AMS Illuminations so that you don't miss out our episodes. If you have a question or topics you'd like to be up for discussion on AMS Illuminations, email ams-web@outlook.com. For more information about AMS and AMS Illuminations, visit ams-web.org.